everyone. Welcome to the 20th episode of the Queer History Podcast. Today, as Queer History begins to explore Black History Month, we'll be looking at the life and activism of Bayard Rustin. Some business reminders, new and old. In about a month, Queer History will be celebrating its one-year anniversary. Laura began this project on their birthday, so in order to make the anniversary extra special, we're trying to gather as many new patrons as possible. It's our goal to be earning $150 per Queer History article by the time we celebrate our one-year anniversary. We have some surprises in store for you as well, so keep an eye on the Queer History Tumblr and website over the next month. Feel free to head over to our Patreon as well and support us as we move towards this special day. If you don't feel like you can become a patron, but you still want to help support Laura and myself, feel free to make a one-time donation to the Making Queer History Project. You can follow the link in our Tumblr description of this episode in order to do so. You're also invited to reblog all of our Tumblr content and to spread awareness about our website. It's been a pleasure to watch our audience grow, and we can't wait to be in touch with more of the queer community in the future. Speaking of the community, Queer History is also partnering with 365 Days of Lesbians this month in order to continue our efforts to connect with other queer content creators. Much like our partnership with Queer Portraits in History last month, we'll be chatting with the folks at 365 Days in order to learn more about the work that they do. Be sure to check out more details about this partnership on the Making Queer History website. Ah, lots of announcements today. Now that those are out of the way, though, we can focus on a man who preferred to live his life behind the scenes of several civil rights movements in the 20th century, Bayard Rustin. I would like to take a moment, however, to reiterate something I've said before. I am a white American. I have no right to speak for any person of color. It's only my job to magnify the voices around me. In continuing with this episode, I promise to do my best to only reiterate the messages Rustin and his fellows proclaimed, and not to interpret them through a white gaze. Bayard Rustin was born in 1912 to a 16-year-old mother. His father was absent for his entire life, and his mother's age led his maternal grandparents to refer to her as his sister, as opposed to his biological mother. These grandparents, called by Randall Kennedy of The Nation, generous, public-spirited, hard-working people, raised Rustin in a healthy and loving environment. Because of their efforts, Rustin was able to attend Wilberforce University after graduating from high school, as well as Cheney State Teachers College. These schools are two of the oldest Black institutions of higher education in the United States, according to Kennedy. Rustin never graduated, however. Biographer John D'Amelio, author of Lost Prophet, The Life and Times of Bayard Rustin, suggests that this may have been because Rustin was caught having sex with a white male fairly close to campus, but this claim is a bit speculative. Rustin, however, was gay. He would be relatively open about his sexuality for the bulk of his life, though he would never publicly declare as much nor involve himself in the fight for queer rights until much later in his life. No, while Rustin was young, he focused on the African-American quest for civil rights. Rustin sat at an intersection that queer history has addressed before. He was a man of color as well as gay. It's important to recognize both of these when talking about his person and how their combination impacted his life and treatment by both communities he was a part of. Rustin was also a pacifist for the bulk, if not whole, of his life. This connection with pacifism began while he was young and in college, wherein he joined the Communist Party USA, according to D'Amelio. He would break from this group not long after, however, in light of the outbreak of World War II, as members of this group wanted to abandon the fight for civil rights in order to focus on the ascent of fascism in Germany and around the world. Kennedy describes this break as follows. First, Rustin created a significant presence for himself with A. Philip Randolph's March on Washington movement, MOWM, which, by threatening to bring masses of blacks to the nation's capital to protest their racist mistreatment, successfully pressured President Franklin Roosevelt into issuing an executive order that prohibited racial discrimination in military plants. Second, Rustin became a follower of the radical pacifist A.J. Must, joining Must's Fellowship of Reconciliation, or four, and impressed upon his new, predominantly white comrades the need to combat racism. Based on this quote, we can see Rustin both deepening his pacifist beliefs while also embracing his position as a civil rights activist. In Rustin's behavior, we witness one of the tenets of intersectionality. The multiple identities of a person cannot be erased, and one cannot be prized over another. Rustin's behavior indicates that he embraced this intersection, resolving never to separate his identity as a civil rights activist and black man from his work in the pacifist movement. To further demonstrate this need, Rustin would found CORE, or the Congress of Racial Equality, after his break with the Communist Party. In 1940, Rostron would travel to India in order to, according to an article by Henry Louis Gates Jr., quote, attend a world pacifist conference. When he returned, he would deliver the following message. We need in every community a group of angelic troublemakers. The only weapon we have is our bodies, and we need to tuck them in places so wheels don't turn. While this message was based in a desire to promote nonviolent protests, it would also lead into some of Rustin's most aggressive activism. According to the Kennedy article, quote, to dramatize the racist intransigence of local officials, Rustin and his comrades disobeyed racial custom and invited arrest. Whites seated themselves in sections of the buses customarily reserved for blacks, and blacks seated themselves in sections customarily reserved for whites, end quote. This work occurred in 1947, but would continue when Rustin met with Martin Luther King Jr. Kennedy describes the partnership between King and Rustin as follows. Quote, Rustin soon became one of King's key speechwriters and advisors, urging King to capitalize on the boycott's momentum by creating a new organization dedicated to advancing the cause of human rights in the South through mass activism. Rustin drafted the founding documents of what became the SCLC and would have liked to administer the SCLC or otherwise serve King on an ongoing open basis. Rustin's position as a leader among civil rights activists is made clear by this poignant involvement and his close work with King. He had a bright mind and a quick hand and should have remained a prominent figure in the civil rights movement for the whole of his life. However, then came 1953 and a day in Pasadena, California. According to D'Amelio, Rustin was arrested while having sex with another man in the back of a parked car. He would be charged with vagrancy and lewd conduct, though would eventually be found guilty to the lighter charge of sexual perversion. Rustin's later lover, Walter Niegel, speaks to this arrest in Stephen Thrasher's BuzzFeed LGBT article, saying that, quote, the Pasadena incident meant that Rustin knew he had to be more careful, but that Rustin's behavior otherwise wouldn't change. Thrasher notes that Niegel speaks to Rustin's persistence and acceptance of himself with a particular pride. The communities Rustin found himself a part of, however, would not take his arrest and subsequent charge so lightly. Martin Luther King Jr. and Rustin continued to work together after Rustin's arrest. It was in 1960, however, according to Kennedy, in the midst of planning a march on the Convention Movement for Freedom Now, that the arrest would come back to haunt Rustin. Adam Clayton Powell, offended and in opposition to the march, would threaten King and his followers with blackmail in order to get them to call off the march. When King didn't respond, Kennedy states that Powell upped the ante, threatening to charge that King and Rustin were having a homosexual affair. In face of that threat and King's unwillingness to confront Powell, Rustin publicly severed all of his ties with SCLC, one of several developments that undercut the proposed demonstrations and rendered them largely ineffectual. Here we see a strong reaction from one of Rustin's communities in response to part of his identity. Consider the fact that homosexuality could be used as blackmail for a moment. What does that say about societal opinions of homosexuality during Rustin's time? What kind of social backlash would King, for example, have faced due to the lies Powell wanted to tell? King was already a man disliked by Republicans and Democrats in the United States government, not to mention the vast majority of white America. Based on Powell's reaction to Rustin's homosexuality and his willingness to extort the malevolent societal feelings surrounding it, would King have lost credibility if similar implications arose around him? Powell seemed to think so. I can't say because I don't know, and because it's not my place to make broad speculations about a subject I don't have a hand in. What I do know is that after Powell's threat, Rustin all but retreated from his work with the civil rights movement. Kennedy goes on to say, however, that, quote, in 1963, however, Rustin reemerged, phoenix-like, at the center of the single most famous demonstration of the era. A. Philip Randolph announced the plan for an emancipation march on Washington for jobs, whereupon Rustin began to translate the vision into reality, end quote. This march, for some of us who may be unaware, was the march at which Martin Luther King Jr. recited his I Have a Dream speech. Rustin was one of the masterminds behind what is now considered one of the most iconic speeches ever delivered on American soil. Still, though, it was evident that opinion of Rustin had been tainted during his disappearance. Rustin's pacifism, according to Gates, wasn't present when the Vietnam War sparked to life, even though, in the past, Rustin had been arrested for resisting the draft and other such pro-war movements. Gates describes Rustin's relationship with the Democratic Party at this point in his life as cozy, and says that this closeness, quote, angered proponents of black power. something had changed in Rustin after his break with SCLC, or perhaps more poignantly, after Powell's threats of blackmail. Yet it was at this point that Rustin became more active within the queer community. Biographer D'Amelio suggests that this was due to the influence of Rustin's aforementioned lover, Walter Neagle. The relationship between Rustin and Neagle was a bit unconventional. Thrasher and BuzzFeed report that Rustin adopted Neagle as his son while retaining him as a lover so that Neagle could inherit Rustin's estate. However, it was with Neagle at his side that Rustin began to speak about his homosexuality. "I did not come out of the closet voluntarily," Rustin says, according to D'Amelio. "Circumstances forced me out. While I have no problem with being publicly identified as homosexual, it would be dishonest of me to present myself as one who was in the forefront of the struggle for gay rights. The credit for that belongs to others." Rustin would go on to offer his support to the fight queer rights until he died on August 24, 1987. Walter Neagle would give an interview several years later, talking about his relationship with Rustin and Rustin's subsequent erasure from the civil rights movement. This interview came in light of Barack Obama's decision to posthumously award Bayard Rustin the Medal of Freedom. Neagle was thrilled by the announcement, according to Thrasher and BuzzFeed, but he was also, quote, "a bit worried that he'd wake up one morning to the headline, 'Obama gives Medal of Freedom to Communist Gay Man.'" Kennedy elaborates on this fear, though in terms of Rustin's erasure from the history he helped create. "Rustin was for many years a forgotten man," he claims. "His obscurity stemmed not only from amnesia, but also from conscious suppression, largely on the part of left liberals and black nationalists who objected to what they saw as a complacent, even retrograde turn in his later years." What are we to make of this? Should Rustin's legacy be erased because of his actions in his later life? If so, does that mean his queerness should subsequently be erased? Many people in the past 3 years, including Making Queer History, say no. Bayard Rustin may not have been a perfect man in the eyes of the people he served, but his presence was essential in the rise of the civil rights movement. He rebelled peacefully and to great success, only to be cut down by a man who wanted to take advantage of society's negative opinions of homosexuality. We do our best to remember him now, with all of his strengths and flaws, because it is our responsibility to remember him. History does not have to be written by perfect men. Rather, we can look back and recognize ourselves in the rises and falls of those who came before us. Thank you for listening, everyone. I hope this episode is a good start to Black History Month and that Laura and myself can continue to bring you inspiring and informative content in the weeks to come. Stay strong, do your best to take care of yourselves, and remember, history is queerer than you think.